Welcome, everybody. Firstly, I just want to acknowledge that we're meeting on land of Whadjuk Noongar people and pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. Co-curator, it's been a fascinating journey. A lot of you will know me and Ted and John, and so can kind of imagine what a fascinating journey that's been working between the three of us. I became director in 2009, and prior to that, Ted Snell was here from 2000 to 2008, and John Barrett Leonard was the founding director who was appointed in 1995, as Lance will remember. The gallery itself, well, I suppose just kind of summing up the exhibition, the reason we're doing this exhibition is that it was a vehicle to celebrate two anniversary milestones this year. One is the 20th anniversary of the gallery, which opened in 1998, and the other is to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the collection, the John Curtin University Art Collection, which was established the year after Waite commenced in 1968. Now, the very first painting that was purchased is actually over on the wall there, a painting by Robert Bell titled Fisher, or is it Fisher's? Fisher. And Robert, along with one other artist in the exhibition, Carol Rudyard, was part of the very first cohort of students enrolled in art here at Waite in 1967. Robert went on to have quite illustrious career curating. His last post was at the National Gallery in Canberra, and he's not doing too well health-wise these days, but certainly has his wits about him and sent us a very, very long, detailed account of everything to do with that work only 9 months ago, which was quite extraordinary given that he painted it 50 years ago. So what I'm planning to do is just walk you through the exhibition, mainly touching on the works, part of my selection. As Sam kind of intimated, the exhibition is sliced into three chapters, each of us being responsible for selecting works from the collection. Now, John and I both selected a number of works which aren't in the collection. We borrowed works from artists, and there are works that we're proposing. It's a little bit weird for John to be proposing, but that was part of the conversation that we had during developing the show. But there's two works that I'm proposing that the collection purchase, and there's four works that John has borrowed, and I'll just quickly touch on those as we walk through. But what I wanted to do was just briefly touch on each of the 20, or is it 19, items that I chose out of the 112, and also just give you a bit of a kind of some touchstones on my connections to the collection itself, as well as the gallery. Obviously, I've been here, as most of you would know, since the gallery opened in 1998, and I was here about 10 years before that. I started working here in 1989. Principally with the collection. Now, at that stage in 1989, I was brought in to do a rather, I wouldn't say unsavory, but it was quite a laborious job of undertaking the stock take, the annual stock take. Now, back in those days, the collection numbered about 2,000 items, and we only had about 50 or 60 in storage. Most of the collection was on campus. As the collection developed through the 60s and 70s, its aim was to be displayed on campus. And it wasn't until the mid-80s that people started really talking and planning to build this place, which became both a storage facility for the collection at large, as well as a place for us to kind of administer and manage how the collection is seen in a different way around campus. Just before we opened here in 1998, in about 1996, which was in the second year of John Barrett Leonard's directorship, we in fact removed every single artwork from campus and took it to an off-site storage over in Rivervale. We spent 12 months cataloguing, condition reporting, reacquainting ourselves with works that many we hadn't seen for a long time because they'd been literally sitting on the same wall in the same place on campus since they were purchased, whenever that may have been. So the idea was that we were going to change the way the collection was kind of negotiated around the campus. And what we are running now is a campus display program where we have about 20% of the collection out on campus at any one time. And those works rotate periodically. And that gives us an opportunity to have kind of much more meaningful contact with the community on campus and for staff and students, but principally staff in terms of contact, direct contact, an opportunity to interface with the collection as well as they participate in the selection process of works that inhabit their areas that they work within. So it gives us opportunities to engage with the Curtin community directly about the collection, and we kind of set it up where people act as custodians, so there's a buy-in with artworks that are in different parts of the campus. And Matthew McAlpine, to my far right, is running that campus display program at the moment and doing a great job, and it's been very successful in terms of turning the collection over and having a sort of sense that it's a dynamic resource rather than a kind of interior decoration service as some people may have considered it in the 1960s and 1970s. In fact, there's one work I'll point out which I discovered on one of my early expeditions doing the stock take, which was something I did on my own, which was quite extraordinary when I recall it now. But I found a Lloyd Rees drawing in a cupboard in a semi-dismantled frame in an abandoned office. And it kind of signifies, well, when I think back, it sort of signifies how differently the collection is considered and how the awareness of what the collection is to Curtin staff has changed so much since the early 90s and late 80s when we were getting ready to actually remove the collection from campus. There were instances of works sort of being taken off the wall and put behind cupboards. I mean, this is common to university art collections around the country, but it was quite mind-boggling to come across it personally at the time. So since the gallery opened in 1998, I mean, obviously we have kind of two principal purposes. One is to be presenting programs within the space that was created, and a lot of those programs, or some of those programs, are drawn from the collection, as this show is, but otherwise the exhibition program is a kind of international contemporary program where we work with artists and curators from around the world. And the storage that we have down below our feet, just a little bit over there, where 80% of the collection is stored in several rooms, that's a kind of state-of-the-art collection facility, which at the moment is brimming full. So we have the kind of conundrum where we're just embarking on a kind of renaissance of acquisition, and as the campus is growing, the collection is growing with it. We don't, in the foreseeable future, have access to greater storage, so we have a kind of dilemma where we're wishing to grow the collection substantially, but the dilemma is we don't have anywhere to store it other than on campus. So in some ways, we've kind of gone back to the position we were in the late 60s, where a lot of the things that we're acquiring start making us think about, one, why we're acquiring it, two, how we can use it, which gets back to the position that informed my selections. So my selections were driven by a very kind of tight criteria where I was choosing works that could not be ordinarily displayed on campus. John Barrett Leonard has chosen very, very differently, and Ted Snell has chosen works that are all by Curtin graduates. So we've got very different focuses. But I was wanting to focus on artworks that reflected different reasons for purchasing other than just going on the wall in someone's office or in a public space. Unfortunately, a couple of the major sculptural works, we had problems with kind of resurrecting some technical aspects of them. They were purchased a long time ago. So most of the works I did ended up selecting in my 20 are wall-based works. And I'll start that conversation with the two that are in my selection that are on the wall here. The first one that I'll speak about, which is number two on my list, is a work that was purchased almost 12 months ago from Brian Blanchflower, who's one of Australia's most respected living artists. He moved to Perth in 1972 after growing up in the Sussex Downs, and he was born in Brighton in southern England. And Brian spent a lot of his youth walking the landscape. He was fascinated with prehistoric sites and prehistoric walking trails. So there's a kind of connection between Brian's work and the next work, which I'm going to talk about, which again is all about country, but in a very, very different way. This is a work that was made in 1990 called Canopy 22, Time Generator. And it's a work that was made 6 years after he started the Canopy series in the mid-80s. And he's still persisting with the canopies, and he's at the moment working on Canopy 77. And so it's a kind of thread right through his practice. And it's actually a quote that I just wanted to read. Brian's not one to talk about his works very often, but I thought this quote was quite telling and would give you some insight in a way that it's coming straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. As I said, Brian never writes about his work. And this is an answer to a question to a show which was dedicated to the canopies that was at the Drill Hall Gallery at ANU 2 years ago. And what he said is, and this in some ways encapsulates his entire practice, "The most important ingredient in my paintings is that which is not painted, the unseen, the unknowable, the unnameable. In other words, the feeling produced by the whole work. We are in a cultural climate dominated by images which merely reflect the world rather than provide a profound," I've got to go to my next page, "experience of the forces at work around us and within us." So Brian is an artist of extraordinary devotion. He works, I mean, he's in a privileged position where he works in his studio every single day. He was born in 1939, so he turns 80 next year. And to meet him, you know, he has this sort of sense of this tenacious, determined devotion and commitment to his practice. And he has been immune to fashion and criticism and is entirely focused, unlike any other artist I've ever met. And for me, as I said in the introduction, is one of the most important living painters in Australia. I've come to know Brian quite well. We had a large exhibition of his here in 2002, and this work was earmarked for an acquisition last year to launch our 50-50 acquisition initiative. So this was a kind of hallmark, a statement that the university made in terms of wanting to seriously recommence what had been a fairly dormant acquisition program for a number of years for a number of reasons. And so this was a statement acquisition that was made 12 months ago and was actually featured in the 50-50 exhibition. A lot of you may have seen that exhibition and would have seen this work. And this again is a work that I can maybe think of one or two walls that this could possibly be installed on campus, but the sort of nature of the work and that has to be nailed in a particular way, etc., would make it almost impossible to install anywhere. And there are other things to consider with campus as well. I mean, a work like this, which is incredibly valuable, we have issues of safety and security in some parts of campus. Not saying that it's an unsafe and insecure campus, but when you're talking about artworks that are normally in a museum context like this, the campus is a very, very different physical context. About $100,000. Yeah. I mean, it's not, when you're talking value, I mean, the Tracy Moffat work here, I don't know what it's currently listed at, but 15 years ago, that was worth maybe $800,000. And in some ways, that reflects Tracy as being, you know, having a kind of meteoric rise in the mid-90s, residing in the Venice Pavilion, for the Australian Pavilion at Venice, and becoming a kind of rock star. Brian's like a hermit who works up in his studio in Bedfordale. He, you know, the world's an irrelevance to him in some ways, but his works are, you know, profoundly intense and very collected. I mean, every state gallery, I mean, almost everything he makes is purchased. Now, moving on to the second painting, and I'll try to move along a bit because otherwise we're... It'll be half past one, but we're still in the atrium. This is a painting, and the reason that these are both here in one way is that this painting was a result of this acquisition. Well, that's a story I'm going to tell anyway. This painting was donated only 2 months ago by one of our long-term donors, who has given us over the years a very large number of good works, solid works. This is a major work that we received as part of a cohort of over 20 works that was donated in April this year. And it's a work by George Ward Chungarai, who was born in, nobody knows exactly when he was born, between 1942 and 1944, as best I can tell, in near the Gibson Desert, northwest of Warburton. His two older brothers are very, very famous artists, Yali Yala Gibbs and Willie Chungarai. Willie Chungarai was one of the founding members of the Papunyatulia in the early 1970s. And when Yali Yala passed away in 1998, a lot of the responsibilities, the cultural responsibilities that he held, were passed on to George. And George had started painting at Kintore in Northern Territory in about 1990. And when his brother Yali Yala passed away in 1998, George's practice changed dramatically. He assumed this, he had this very serious responsibility of a custodian of ancient songs, storylines, and this work in fact depicts a kind of clay pan area known as Kurumalunya. And the title of the work is in fact Soakage Water at Kurumalunya, and is a very common motif that he paints in many of his works. And interestingly, part of my dilemma with designing the show was trying to find something that could sit on the wall next to Tracy Moffat. Tracy Moffat to me is like a stained glass window. You know, it's probably one of the most physically magnificent object we have in the collection on the wall. And again, I was looking at the works that I was choosing from and trying to find something that could live on the wall next to something as dramatic and as high key, high, you know, high contrast, high colour as that. And to my mind, George Ward Chungarai does. I mean, there's a mesmeric quality to the painting and a meticulous execution where he feels, well, to my eyes, every mark on this painting is imbued with a sense of concentration and focus that is common to the way Brian Blanchflower works. So anyway, that's why George is here. It's great to have such a major work donated recently as part of our 50-50 initiative, which we're aiming to complete by 2020, and which will be an exhibition here in 2020 of the 50 works that we've acquired. So next I'm going to walk into the space and I'm going to show you two works that are in John Barrett Leonard's selection, then I'll move into the Central Gallery. As we're moving through, I'll just point out that this wall, the eastern wall, contains three works that aren't in the collection, but these are works that were borrowed as a suggestion to, you know, possibly being considered for acquisition. Max Pam on the left, Daniel Crook's video, which is his latest work, which is recently on the wall at Anna Schwartz in the centre, and Jurek Wabernick. We've got large work holdings of Max Pam in the collection already. We have some work of Jurek Wabernick, and we have no work of Daniel Crooks at the moment. And the other work that John has borrowed, or we borrowed through John, is the Julie Goff, which is the double screen work in the rest area, but we'll see that passing through. Now, the two artworks I wanted to point out, one was a painting by George Ward Chungarai's older brother, Willie Chungarai, who again was one of the founding members of Papunya, Papunyatulia. This is a work that was acquired in 1982, very, very long time ago. It's almost identical size to the Clifford Possum, which was acquired at the same time. Now, the other work I wanted to point out was the drawing that I found in the cupboard back in 1990, which is this Lloyd Rees drawing. It was in a, as I said, it was in a frame that had come apart, and the person whose office it was, instead of ringing me or ringing whoever and telling them that they'd, you know, that this work had fallen off the wall or whatever, they just literally put it in a cupboard And then as that building was, they were getting ready to paint the building. It was building, it was the education building. And as they were getting ready to paint, people were moving out, and so this was just left in the cupboard. So I was going around making sure there was nothing left in the building before the painters came in and found this. I've studied painting here in the early 80s and have long been a great admirer of Lloyd Rees, and this is only one of two works I think we have of Lloyd Rees in the collection. The other is a major painting which was actually part of the 50-50 exhibition. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out because, you know, there's a lot of interesting, funny stories like that. And when I was doing the stock take, as I mentioned, I had to do that on my own over every year for 3 years. And that gave me a great... Not long after that, I became the assistant curator and then the curator. And so I had a great understanding of the physicality of the collection and where everything was on campus, which was quite unusual. I must admit that I don't get out on campus nearly, you know, anywhere near that now. So, but soon I'll be going back out with Matt and the collections team to refamiliarise myself with some new aspects of the campus, as well as the Greater Curtin project, which is coming online this year, which again is going to free up and create some interesting spaces that we're hoping will become more like gallery spaces rather than us fitting artworks in between bits where architects have left blanks. We're trying to create some blanks so that we can utilise some of these larger, more awkward objects rather than having to, you know, only consider acquiring things of this scale that would readily fit on an office wall. It's very limiting when you're developing a collection. So we'll just move into the central gallery. Again, those who know all three of us, I mean, I've positioned myself between John and Ted, so we're not following any chronology. And I wanted to start with a painting by John Beard, who's a very, very well-respected Welsh-born painter who came to Perth in 1982 to become the head of fine art at the art school. That was my last year here at Curtin, and I got to know John fairly well for a couple of years. He was only here, well, he was only teaching until 1989, and then dedicated since then. Since 1989, he's dedicated his entire being to his practice, and he's done very, very well. 2006, he won the Archibald Prize. 2007, he won the Wynne Prize for, or maybe it's the other way around, which is quite bizarre. I mean, he's, you know, wins a portrait prize, and next year he wins a landscape prize. Since probably the last 15 years, he's concentrated on massive paintings, interrogating landscapes close to where he lives in the UK. Now, this is a work that was on the wall. I remember seeing this in an exhibition at the Dusseldorf Gallery in 1983. And at that time in Perth, especially in the art school, this, I mean, his practice, him coming here, introducing what was a very contentious style at that time in the early 80s, caused a lot of noise. He was quite a rambunctious character and had a great program of artists in residence, bringing some magnificent people from the UK. I won't tell the sordid stories of some of them, but this work was only acquired many, many years after it was made in 1996, and this is another donation to the collection. We have another work of John's of the similar period, which is almost twice as large, which was in the 50-50 collection. And again, there's very few walls in the university that can deal with a work of this height. So that's another reason why it became a target for mine, for my selections. The title of the work is called Riff Raff. And I remember very clearly walking around with a student group in 1983 and hearing John talk about this amongst the other works. And I mean, as hard as it might seem now, this was an entirely new visual language for Perth in 1982. And it seems very familiar now, but back then it was really quite contentious. And in fact, the School of Art here, it had a long history with very well-respected English philosopher and art critic Peter Fuller, who had been coming here for a number of years. And Peter Fuller hated this guy's practice, saw this as a kind of thin edge of the wedge of a New York school of bad painting, as it was called, this international style. So there was this quite loud conversation going between two streams of thought, between a much more conservative English tradition and this infiltration of what was described as this kind of American sort of noise. Again, looking back and looking at this now, it seems almost hard to believe. Now, contemporary with that work is a large work on the far wall, which again, this is the largest painting we have in the collection. This is by Sidney Ball, who passed away only last year. He was born in 1933. Now, Sid travelled to New York in the early 60s, I think it was late 62, early 63, and had a stellar career. He was one of the major artists selected in the Field exhibition in 1968 at the NGV that was co-curated by John Stringer, which has just been resurrected, the Field revisited at the moment. And throughout his career, Sid Ball had kind of oscillated between a series of styles. He spent many years in different periods painting like Jackson Pollock. He had access to a lot of kind of New York-based artists like Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, Frankenthaler, and there were a lot of work that he did on the floor, spilling and pouring and throwing stains. There were very few works that he did that were landscape-based, and I've seen interviews of him talking about landscape, and you know, as soon as you put a horizontal line in a horizontal aspect canvas, in his mind it became a landscape. And so in terms of his practice, this is a very figurative work. I mean, there's a figure on the left with a face. This work was, again, it's called Chimerian Icons, and it's completely contemporaneous with John Beard's work. I'm not sure, but I've also heard a tale that this could have been painted here in Perth. I've been told that he did a short residency here in Perth, but we haven't been able to sort of nail that fact yet, the provenance. So again, this is the largest object in the collection, and certainly won't fit on any wall on campus. Now these two works here, the work on the floor and the work on the wall. The work on the floor is a work by Susan Flavelle. It's a woven rug. And the drawing on the wall is by Thea Costantino. And both of these works were in an exhibition whose name I always forget. That's the one. Huh?
It goes on more than that.
What, the title?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, this is a drawing of an x-ray of Sigmund Freud's skull. This is a depiction of a howling wolf with a pattern from a rug from the floor in Freud's consulting rooms, which was recreated in the Freud Museum in London. Both of these artists were part of a cohort of artists who travelled to London in 2013 on a kind of group residency at the Freud Museum. And the outcome of that residency was the exhibition at Pica, of which these two artists were part of. Both of these works were donated to the collection by the artist. So that's another stream of acquisitions where we have opportunity to prize works from artists' own collections. Other notable artists that we've acquired works in that way are also Brian Blanchflower, who occasionally will gift a major work. And there's a benefit to them through, depending on how they do that, through a reduction in tax liability through cultural gifts program of the Australian Taxation Office. And so that's another way that we can acquire works, although it's often difficult to control what those works are. But in this instance, we know these artists very well, and so the acquisition outcome is part of a kind of intimate conversation with the artists. They're not just sort of lobbing up and giving us something that we don't necessarily want. Both these artists are Curtin grads. Susan was actually here when I was here in the early 80s, and Thea was a much, much later student who's currently living in England, although I believe returning soon. On the short slope wall is a work by Lisa Rehana, who's was featured in our festival exhibition earlier this year. And this is in fact a still from the video In Pursuit of Venus Infected, which I think probably most of you would have seen, which was in the Northern Gallery. This is a work, and again, I need to consult the title because her titles are quite bizarre. Banks, Transit of Venus, Morning, Stars, Sex Trade, 15375. And that's a kind of fairly bland description of these vignettes. Each of the vignettes that she filmed had specific titles. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4 vignettes, and the number depicts the actual exact frame that this is lifted out of a video work, which is made up of hundreds of thousands of frames. This again is a work pending acquisition. It's a work I'm very keen to acquire, and I mean, in many ways, and I've described this to groups that I've talked to specifically in here, I see Lisa right now being at the point where that Tracy Moffat was in the early 1990s, just before Tracy's work went from being worth $30,000 to almost $1 million. That's where Lisa is right now. She's become notorious for the extraordinary work that she presented for the New Zealand Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. And there's great interest in her work all over the world. Museums are just clamoring to get hold of that work in particular. The cluster of works on this southern wall, most of you will be very familiar with, are drawn from the Herbert Mayer collection of Carolup artwork, which was transferred, the custodianship was transferred to Curtin University in April 2013. These are all works that were produced between 1946 and 1950. We don't have any hard dates on any of them, except one. The Barry Lew landscape watercolour was produced in 1950 when he was working in the Department for Native Affairs, 18 months after he left Carolup in 1948. But the other works, we can only assume that the larger they are, the later they are, the smaller they are, the earlier they are. Beyond that, we don't have any hard provenance as to dates. There's a lot of research that we still need to do. But as most of you will know, this is just a small selection of the 122 works that were gifted. Now, their scale would permit these to be exhibited anywhere, but they are incredibly fragile. They're all works on paper. Most of them are dry pigment, sitting on paper, except for the watercolour in this instance. So just moving them is fraught with danger in terms of deterioration of their physicality. They're all very sensitive to deterioration from light. They spent most of their life in a cardboard box until they were discovered in 2004. So part of the reason that they're still so vibrant is that they haven't been out on display much. We're grappling with the issue of we're kind of charged with making these accessible, but also preserving them. And as you would well imagine, they're two different sides of the same coin. So it's very difficult to do both. But I thought it was important to include these. Again, most people would come in and wonder why these couldn't be used on campus display. And it's really those issues around their fragility. But the other reason I've included them in the exhibition is that it also points to a different reason that these are in the collection. Some people would argue that in an art collection that is principally focused on post-1960s contemporary Australian art, if you wanted to look at the primary collecting guideline, and then it filters down through different layers, in many ways this doesn't fit that bill. But in other ways, I see this as an incredibly important resource that the university has yet to seriously take advantage of, if I could use that word. The programs that we've been able to, or in the kind of engagements we've been able to orchestrate that bring people together, both survivors of this period at Carolup and subsequent generations who are all suffering all sorts of ills from the policies of previous governments and stolen generations issues, this collection is an absolute it's an extraordinary asset to be able to prosecute a case for change and to engage with people and allow all sorts of things to unfold. And we've only sort of scratched the surface. And so for my mind, this is a very important resource, and it's a finite resource. I mean, we can't, we're unlikely to collect more of these works. There's not more of these works in existence. There may be some which we may find in subsequent years in the United Kingdom. But for the time being, this is a very unique collection of historically important and culturally significant works that I see as one of the most useful objects we have in the collection in terms of us engaging with the community and being able to be a part of social change. Again, half of these works on the wall are anonymous. We don't actually know who created them, and that's a kind of burning concern for me, because what underpins the success of that engagement is connection to people who are literally connected to these works. And so once we identify everybody, then that opens doors to direct connection with other living descendants, which will just extend that impact. The next work, when we go around behind the sliding walls, is work by Abdul Rahman Abdullah. So this is the second last object in my list, and this is the other work that I've borrowed. The title of the work is 500 Books, and so the story goes, according to Abdul Rahman, in 1988, when he just turned 11, and he walked into his father's garage and he saw what he just thought was a big box with a sheet over it. When he peeled the sheet back, he saw literally a stack of 500 books. Now, these books were rescued from a publisher who, they were books that were printed in 1977, and they were of work by, and I'm pretty sure it was a Jalaluddin Rumi, the 13th century Sufi poet, and it was the entire print run of this book, and his father had rescued it and was keeping it. And this was the first time that Abdul Rahman, who was an avid reader and very, very curious young fellow, had ever seen so many of the same book. And he was intrigued by why his father had so many of the same book. This is carved out of wood. It's painted with oil-based paints, and he's also used aluminium foil, much the way that you'd use gilt foil to render the surfaces of the books, which are anonymous objects. And for me, this has many, many resonances with Abdul Rahman's own cultural identity and his own cultural heritage. He's a young man, again, another graduate from Curtin University, whose family, he has mixed heritage, and he's grown up in a Muslim family in Australia. And his practice is incredibly acute and very sharp, and he's in great demand. He's a very intelligent guy, and obviously has extraordinary skills in terms of how he crafts things out of timber. He works a lot with animal forms as well, and a lot of his objects are kind of captured moments in his own family history. But you know, so this is an innocent moment where he found this pile of books, but there's so much more going on. I mean, I can read other layers of into this about people in the Islamic community wanting to be hidden and cloaked, and aspects of their culture being revealed. It also has a striking resemblance to the which I actually haven't spoken to you about yet, to the Kaaba at Mecca, which is the structure around which the devotees at the Hajj circumambulate. It's very, very layered with all sorts of meanings, and it's an extraordinary piece of sculpting. And he was very interested in people, you know, from a distance, getting a complete slight trompe l'oeil, getting a complete illusion that this is just a stack of books with a sheet on it. But he was quite happy then, as soon as you start walking towards it, you immediately see that it's not that. It's made out of other materials, and so he's not trying to hide the imperfections in the carving or when one material joins another. He was quite happy for people to be, for that illusion to be completely and utterly obliterated. And then you start sort of thinking about it in very, very different terms. So 500 books. Now the last work is blank. No, it was blank. Now this has an extraordinary soundtrack. This is a work by Carol Rudyard called Apocryphal Tales from 1994. Now Carol Rudyard is still with us. She turns 96 this year. And she came to Australia in 1952 or 53 and lived in the same house in Abbotsford Street in West Leadville until only a few months ago. She was a painter of kind of hard-edged abstraction painter, very good friend of Brian Blanchflower's, and as I mentioned earlier, she was part of that very first cohort of students here at Curtin in 1967 when it was Waite. She gave up painting because she thought it was she wanted to pursue new media in 1973. So her most recent paintings date from 1973. Then she started working with photography and time-based film. Now this is a work, again, when I think back to 1994, it doesn't seem that long ago in some sense, but she didn't have access to any of the kind of editing software that video artists would work with now, like Julie Goff or Daniel Crooks. So there's a kind of raw, pixelated quality to some of this in terms of how the image has been transferred from analog medium to digital medium. But the other thing to bear in mind is that this entire video was edited in camera. She wasn't able to edit this post-shooting, so she was shooting this and editing it in camera at the same time, which is quite extraordinary. And all of the props, all of these works, all the two-dimensional works, are actually still in her possession, and many of those works became two-dimensional works in their own right. You can just hear faint glimmers. There's a really interesting soundtrack, which would sadly be too invasive for the space, so we've got it on headphones at the moment. I work on videotape. It seems ancient. You know, it wasn't that long ago. Now, the other thing about the show was that there was some misconception. People might have thought that this was all about, you know, well, these are the works I bought, these are the works I bought, these are the works that he bought. And it's not like that at all. I haven't bought a great deal, to be honest. But this is a work that was purchased when I was curator before John Barrett Leonard was appointed the founding director. I've known Carol a very, very long time, and she's always admired how works have been displayed here. She's a state living treasure. Her work's in collections of every major museum in the country, and yet she's still sort of under-recognised in many ways. And again, turning 96 this year, she's not going to be with us much longer. So I thought it was very important to have a work of hers in this exhibition. And of course, this is a work that we can't have on campus display generally. We don't have a huge collection of video and time-based works, but this was an example that I thought would kind of, especially the way that it's actually projected inside this gilt frame, was a kind of marriage between, you know, the convention of a two-dimensional work hanging on the wall as well as a video projection. And this is a work that, in her mind, can never be put onto a screen. So we couldn't, like, project or have it on a screen, because there are screens around campus where we could, in fact, show video works that we have. But this is, there's a physicality about how her videos are presented as part of an installation. And the soundtrack is actually constructed in collaboration with a couple of artists, most notably Ross Bolliter, who is a local-based composer who used to play prepared pianos. And she worked very closely with Ross over many, many years. So that's the last work officially on my list. But there's one more work that would have been on my list, which is Noel de Sel's Blanket. Now, of the 3,000 works in the collection, this is the only work that Ted, John and I all had on our list. This is the only common denominator. And in the end, it was quite a kind of tussle between Ted and John as to, you know, whose space it was going to be in, and it's ended up in Ted's space. And in some ways, there's a kind of segue between my work and the work in Ted's list. And on that note, I'll thank you all for coming, and hope to see you again some other time.